Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention? I'm Rod Finkel, the president of the council. Thank you all for coming today. I just want to remind you that our presentations do not reflect the opinions of the council, and we ask that you make your own decisions on controversial issues. We remain neutral. I'd like to thank Will Tour today, who is recording for us. They are available for your listening pleasure. They can be downloaded also from KSKA Public Radio website. I'd like now to introduce our head table. To my far left is Cheryl Myers, who is a fellow board member. And sitting next to her on her right is Ann Lovejoy, who is also a board member. Has been for some time, and she will do the honors today by introducing our guest speaker, who is also a fellow board member.
Hello. It's my pleasure today to introduce Dr. Tim Thomas. Tim is a medical epidemiologist. He works for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and I noticed a number of the CDC folks are at the table over here to our left. He's in the Arctic Investigations Program. The AIP has a staff of over 35 and provides support for infectious disease and research studies through applied epidemiology, laboratory, computer, and statistical sciences. Their facility is on the Alaska Native Medical Center off Tudor Street. Tim is a graduate of Indiana University Medical School. After completing a family practice residency in West Virginia, he did medical work in Somalia and Kenya. Tim has also worked for local Alaska Native healthcare corporations in Bethel and in Anchorage. Tim recently returned from the CDC field station in Kenya, where he was conducting HIV research from 2001 to 2008. This posting was a return home for him. He grew up in Kenya. Tim is an Alaska World Affairs Council board member, and we are delighted to hear about his work in Kenya. Please join me in welcoming him to our podium.
Thank you very much for that introduction. And it's great to see my colleagues here and also family and friends also. So thank you for coming, everyone. Although I'm giving this talk today because the scheduled speaker was not able to, the timing is actually fortuitous, as December 1st, this Tuesday, was World AIDS Day. And that's a day that to remember friends and family members we have lost to this epidemic, and to renew the commitment to ending the spread of HIV/AIDS. One thing that CDC is encouraging everyone to do is to get tested to know their status. So I would encourage everybody to visit, if you don't know where to get tested, visit www.hivtest.org and get to know your status and or talk to your healthcare provider. As mentioned, I returned from Kenya in August last year. And I'd been there since 2001 doing HIV-related research at the CDC field station in Western Kenya. In my presentation today, I want to go from describing the global HIV situation to discussing the situation in Kenya, and then discussing some of the interventions that are currently being promoted in Kenya, and then to talk a little bit about the work that I was doing on prevention of mother-to-child transmission. Unrelated to CDC activities, my wife, Michelle Thomas, and I became very involved in supporting an orphanage, and I would like to talk briefly about that also. Many of the pictures of children that you will see in this presentation are taken from the orphanage. The picture of our globe, shows Africa, and primarily sub-Saharan Africa, the area that has been overwhelmingly devastated by the HIV epidemic. In 2003, Stephen Lewis, the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa, captured the extent of the devastation well in describing a village he went to in Zambia. He said, "We were taken to a village where the orphan population was described as out of control. As a vivid example of that, we entered a home and encountered the following. To the immediate left of the door sat the 84-year-old patriarch, entirely blind. Inside the hut sat his two wives, visibly frail, one 76, the other 78. Between them, they had given birth to 9 children. 8 were now dead, and the 9th, alas, was clearly dying. On the floor of the hut, jammed together with barely room to move or breathe, were 32 orphaned children, ranging in age from 2 to 16. It is now commonplace that grandmothers are the caregivers for orphans. The grandmothers are impoverished, their days are numbered, and the decimation of families is so complete that there's often no one left in the generation coming up behind. We're all struggling to find a viable response, and there are, of course, some superb projects and initiatives in all countries, but we can't seem to take them to scale. UNAIDS estimates that about 33 million people, adults and children, were living with HIV in 2007, the latest year for which they have provided this data. 22 million, or 66% of those people, live in sub-Saharan Africa. I've abbreviated here as SSA. In that same year, UNAIDS estimates that there were 2.7 million new HIV infections. Again, the overwhelming majority, 70% of them, in sub-Saharan Africa. This 2.7 million equates to about 7,400 new infections each day, including about 1,000 children under the age of 15 years of age. This graph, also from UNAIDS, shows the estimated number of adult and children deaths due to AIDS for each year from 1990 to 2007, showing just over 2 million deaths due to AIDS in 2007. You can see that the number of deaths in 06 and 07 were perhaps slightly lower, and this could partly be attributed to the widening access to antiretrovirals around the world. HIV/AIDS is the 6th leading cause of death worldwide, but according to a recent WHO report, it is the leading cause of death among females aged 15 through 44. Over 50% of HIV infections in Africa are among women, and heterosexual sex is responsible for the vast majority of HIV infections worldwide. I'd like to remind everyone that Africa is not a country. It is a continent, roughly 3 times the size of the United States, with about 3 times the population. And the HIV situation differs considerably across the countries of the continent. This map shows the HIV prevalence in different countries around the world. Note the southern part of Africa, shaded in dark red, that has an adult prevalence between 15 and 28%. But in the north, in countries like Egypt in gray, the prevalence is less than 0.1%. Kenya, located on the equator right here, is shaded in a lighter red on this map, reflecting an adult prevalence in the 5 to 15% range. I want to shift to talk now about Kenya, a country a little smaller than Texas, of course much smaller than Alaska, with a population of around 35 million and a per capita annual income of about $350. This graph shows the trends in HIV prevalence in Kenya among adults 15 through 49 years between 1980 and 2006, based on a model that incorporated data from testing at sexually transmitted infection clinics and antenatal clinics. And the graph shows the prevalence peaking in around 1997, around 9%, and the prevalence has been coming down to about 5% in 2006. Prevalence can sometimes be a bit misleading, especially in the age of antiretrovirals. Now that more and more people are getting on antiretrovirals, they're living longer. So we might actually start to see prevalence leveling off as more and more people get on antiretrovirals. It doesn't necessarily mean that we are not succeeding in addressing the epidemic, but it means that perhaps that we need a different measure of what's happening with HIV, and that would be the number of reducing the number of actually new infections rather than just the measure of prevalence. In 2007, a large nationwide HIV survey amongst 15 to 64-year-old individuals was conducted in Kenya. And the survey obtained data on people's sexual behavior and attitude towards HIV testing. And the next few slides show data from that survey. The overall prevalence among those aged 15 through 64 was 7.4%. And this is equivalent to about 1.4 million Kenyans who are HIV infected. Approximately 60% of those were females. The survey also found that in 10% of married couples, at least one person was HIV infected. For comparison, the prevalence in the United States is less than 1%, and that's equivalent in this country to about 1.2 million people living with HIV. And approximately 75% of those infected in this country are males. The prevalence of 7.4% is perhaps is higher than the one I just showed you in the previous graph, and this may reflect the different populations that are used in these different surveys. This graph shows the prevalence on this axis here, the y-axis, and then along the x-axis here is age in age groups, five-year age increments. The overall prevalence is shown in the black line here, with females in red and males in blue. Note the large difference between males and females up to about the age of 34. This big difference here, with a peak for the females around just under 14% amongst 30 to 34-year-old females. The males tending to be a little bit lower up until the 40s, but still, you can see that 50 to 54-year-old individuals, there's still a fairly high prevalence of 8%. I don't know how many people are in this room right now, probably 100. It would mean probably around 8 to 10% of everybody in this room was HIV infected. Similar to the variation in prevalence that we saw across Africa, in Kenya we also see a big difference across the different provinces of the country, with prevalence in the provinces of Nairobi, here in the middle here, in western Kenya, in Nyanza, and on the coast that are much higher or a bit higher than the overall prevalence for the country. But then in some provinces, here in central and northeast, the prevalence is quite a lot lower. I want to pose the question, perhaps, do people have any ideas why there might be such a variation in prevalence across the country? Any thoughts? Religion, yes. Transportation. The transportation, there's a big city of Mombasa is down here on the coast, and did anybody read that book, The Hot Zone, by Crichton, was it? Anyway, he talks about the AIDS highway. And that highway essentially goes from Mombasa here on the coast through Nairobi out here to Uganda. So yes, transportation. Any other thoughts?
Employment? Education?
No, probably, people in Nyanza are just as educated as they are in Central.
What about employment?
Employment would be... I'm not sure that necessarily would be a good reason.
Tribal?
Ethnic reasons, yes. So there is a fair amount of sort of rural, urban, back to rural migration. Yes. Anyway, there are a lot of different reasons, and certainly urban to rural migration. People are migrating into the cities for care once they get diagnosed as HIV infected. people mentioned religious. This part of eastern and northeastern Kenya is predominantly inhabited by Somalis who are Muslims, so who practice circumcision. So circumcision may be a major factor. A lot of other ethnic groups in Kenya do practice circumcision, but here in Western Kenya, the Luo ethnic group that lives in this area do not practice circumcision. And also there may be different sort of timings of the epidemic. It may be at different stages in different parts of the country. Having started more to the west of Kenya in Uganda and further west in Cameroon. So I mentioned circumcision. This graph illustrates HIV prevalence. Again, you're going to have to get used to this. I've got prevalence on the y-axis here and age groups along the x-axis. You may see this graph several more times. But this one shows the prevalence of HIV by circumcision status. And on the yellow line are people who are circumcised, and in the blue line are the uncircumcised. The other way around. So yellow is uncircumcised, blue is circumcised. And you can see that the prevalence amongst the uncircumcised across many of these age groups is about 3 to 4 times higher. Much of the country does actually practice circumcision. About 80% of the country are from ethnic groups that practice circumcision. It's primarily conducted in adolescence as a rite of passage to adulthood rather than for religious reasons or at a young age. So what are the prevention measures that are currently being promoted in Kenya by the Ministry of Health? One of the key prevention tools promoted in Kenya and much of sub-Saharan Africa, and as I mentioned here earlier, in the United States, is to get people to go for HIV testing so that they know their status. Other prevention measures include promotion of condoms, delaying initiation of sex, reducing the number of partners, treating sexually transmitted infections or STIs, circumcision, as I mentioned, treatment with antiretrovirals, prevention of mother-to-child transmission. There are trials that have been conducted on vaginal microbicides and HIV vaccines, but on the whole, those have been very disappointing to date. And I'm going to discuss a little bit about various aspects of these intervention methods as I go through. So who should be tested in these countries with high prevalence? Posters like this are all over Kenya, encouraging people to go to voluntarily counseling testing. This poster says, "If I'm healthy, do I still need an HIV test? Discuss this question at a VCT center near you." VCT means voluntary counseling and testing. And there's been an increasing push in many countries with a high prevalence, but countries like Botswana, that says that every time you go to a health clinic, you're going to be tested. Many other countries have worked to implement what they call an opt-out strategy that tests certain target populations, pregnant women, and that's also being done here in the United States, inpatients and TB patients. Opt-out strategy means that when you go to see your healthcare provider, your healthcare provider will say, "We routinely test for HIV in this clinic." You have an option to decide you don't want to get tested, but we basically are routinely test. As opposed to what has been done in the past, the sort of the opt-in strategy where patients were counseled a lot about HIV, then there was a sort of, an opportunity to say, do you want the test, do you not want the test? Now people are saying, we're doing the test, you have to tell us you don't want it. VCT centers are scattered all over the country now, either attached to a health facility or a standalone. Testing is done in the room with the client using rapid tests. And these tests test for antibodies to HIV. The tests are accurate. They provide immediate results. They use a small amount of blood from a finger stick. The test is done in front of the client, so there is confidence in that it was their blood that was being tested. It supplements the counseling process and decreases waiting time. And in Kenya, much of that HIV testing is done by counselors. During Obama's visit to Kenya in 2006, CDC actually organized for him and his wife to go for HIV testing publicly as a way to promote voluntary counseling and testing. So these rapid tests meet a lot of things that people like. They can be done in private. It's confidential. It's very accessible, affordable, essentially free, and very convenient. And from the Ministry of Health point of view, you can get broad coverage of testing. You can avoid diverting a lot of healthcare workers away from their other duties, and there are very limited demands on the laboratory. You can see in these pictures that I put up here, here's a VCT counselor who's on his bicycle. He's got a box here with test kits, and he's off to go and do testing out in some rural area. Here's a household. This family has been tested at their home. Here's a sign in Nairobi saying, you know, announcing where there's a VCT center. When I first arrived in Kenya in 2001, the VCT was really just beginning, and people were very hesitant to go for testing, and particularly hesitant to go for testing in the same town where they lived, because they thought they might the counselor might know them. They thought that if people see them going for HIV testing, that was, you know, a marker that they probably had HIV. And so people were, it took a long time to sort of get going. Today, people are, if they see a counselor who's on his bicycle, they might stop him and say, here's my finger, test me now. Here's a public event in Kisumu at the park. You can't see it very well, but there are counselors all over here sitting with either an individual or with a couple doing testing out in the open. So testing has become normalized and very acceptable in the country. All over the country, there are billboards encouraging people to go, and couples, to go and get tested. This phrase here, chanukeni pamoja, means get smart or get educated together. This poster here says, stop AIDS, keep the promise, get tested, know your HIV status. All over the country, people are being encouraged to go for testing. So given the push for testing over the last 8 years, what were the findings from the 2007 survey that I mentioned regarding HIV testing and knowledge? In fact, only overall about 36% of people had ever been tested and know their status. More so amongst women, 43% of the females had ever been tested, and that's mostly because they're getting tested through antenatal clinics, and only 25% of males. What are the reasons that people gave for not testing? And that's probably the true in this situation, in this country as well. The most common reason for not testing was low perception of risk. People don't think that they're at risk, 61%. Others didn't want to know their test results or afraid others would know their results. Some were unaware that there was a test for HIV or didn't know where to go and get tested. Some said that it was too far away to go. People were actually, it's free, so people, there was no issues around cost. One of the concerns that people have had in the past, sort of early on, was that their antiretrovirals were not widely available. So they said, if I get tested and I become positive, what's going to happen? There's no drugs available, so it's not going to make any difference. Now that antiretrovirals are so much more widely available in the country, I think that's also a reason why more and more people are going for testing. I mentioned perception of risk. Perception of risk is reflected somewhat in this pie chart, which demonstrates the knowledge of HIV status amongst those who actually tested positive during that same survey. 56% of those infected had never tested for HIV, and an additional 26% reported that they were negative, where in fact they were positive. So up to 82% did not know their HIV status. And only 16% of those HIV infected knew their status before the survey. So in summary, regarding HIV testing, more than half of Kenyan women have never been tested for HIV, and 75% of Kenyan men have never been tested. And as many as 4 out of 5 HIV-infected Kenyans don't know that they are infected. And a critical barrier is people's perception of risk. Condom use is another intervention being heavily promoted through social marketing using billboards and TV spots featuring well-known personalities. This is a friend of mine, Nicholas, and he works for a nonprofit organization sponsored by PSI, Population Services International. And they are supporting the sale of condoms. They're branded as the Trust condom. He drives around this pickup truck with Trust written all over it. This is a band called Kleptomaniacs, a well-known band in Kenya. These guys are all showing us their condom packets. Kleptomaniacs, it says Kleptomaniacs Wanazao. They have theirs. Je, Unayako, do you have yours? So while condoms are widely promoted and available free at many health centers, the survey showed that less than 50%, this is amongst the question to those who are HIV infected and sexually active, less than 50% of them had ever used the condom, and less than 20% used the condom at last sex with the partner who is either HIV negative or whose status they were unaware of. So there's a lot of work to be done in that area as well. I mentioned delay in initiation of sex and reduction in numbers of partners as an additional prevention strategy promoted. This table shows the proportion of individuals interviewed in the 2007 survey and an earlier survey done in 1998 who reported having had sex by 15 years of age. In 1998, 15% of females and 32% of males had reported having had sex by the age of 15 years of age. In 2007, you can see the proportion for males and females has decreased. I also included in the table some data from a CDC survey of over 12,000 individuals aged 15 through 44 in the United States done in 2002 that showed that roughly 25% of individuals in that survey reported having had sex by age 15. And I provided a reference down here. This is a table that shows the proportion of participants in the same two surveys who reported having more than one sex partner in the previous 12 months. In 1998, 4% of females reported having had more than one sex partner in the last 12 months, compared to 24% of males. By 2007, those proportions had dropped by over 50%. Note also the U.S. figures from the same survey showing around 13% of females and around 18% of males reported having had sex with more than one sex partner in the last 12 months. I showed you some data on the prevalence of HIV and circumcision status. This is certainly another intervention that is being promoted in many countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Three studies were recently completed in Uganda, South Africa, and Kenya. They enrolled HIV-negative men and randomized them to either circumcision or no circumcision, and then followed the men for 2 years testing for HIV infection at multiple time points. The results across all three studies were quite consistent and showed over a 50% reduction in transmission amongst the circumcised. The question is whether this effect will be sustained or offset by what we call risk disinhibition. That is, those people who are circumcised might think that now that they're protected and can engage in risky sex behavior. So the long-term effects of circumcision remain to be seen. However, it is currently being promoted amongst adult males in areas of Kenya where circumcision is not the custom. For a minute, I'm going to put my Kenyan Tourism Board hat on. It really is a beautiful country, and I would encourage everyone to go visit. Moving on. Putting more people on antiretrovirals may help in reducing infections. Unfortunately, many transmissions take place when an individual is healthy and does not know that he or she is infected and therefore is not on treatment. This UNAIDS graph shows the exponential increase in access to antiretrovirals in low and middle income countries from 2002 through 2007. in the brown are the sub-Saharan African countries, and you can see that a lot of this exponential increase is really driven by the access to antiretrovirals in Africa. Much of this is a result of funding from the U.S. government through the Presidential Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or otherwise known as PEPFAR. However, while a lot of people have been able to access antiretrovirals in Kenya, there are estimates that only 35% of the 380,000 people who are HIV infected and should be on treatment are actually on antiretrovirals. Most of those who need to be on treatment, this group here, the 63%, they need to be on antiretrovirals, but they really don't know their status. Maybe I should step back and say not everybody with HIV needs immediately to be on treatment. The estimates are that about a third of any given population at a given time needs to be, their CD4 counts, their stage of disease has advanced to the point where they need to be on antiretrovirals. So I want to shift now, and we're sort of honing down on where I was doing a lot of my work, and that was in Western Kenya, where the CDC has a field station. CDC has had a field station in the city of, or just near the city of Kisumu. And I just want to do a little quiz here for the high school students. What lake do you think this is in Africa? This is just restricted to the high school students. And if they can't answer it, we'll go to others. High school students? Any geography teachers in this room? Yes?
Victoria.
Lake Victoria. Okay, very good. Yes. Who won the raffle prize? I think it goes... No. And it's the source of which river? The Nile. So the Nile comes through Uganda, through Sudan, and through Egypt. So enough of geography. this is a picture of... Most people around Lake Victoria are fishermen, and this is a fairly typical fishing boat. So, as I mentioned, CDC has had a field station in Western Kenya since 1979. They just celebrated 30 years. And it's a region with many diseases of major public health significance, not only for Kenya, but worldwide. This part of Kenya has the highest incidence of malaria in the country, and the highest prevalence, a very high prevalence of drug resistance to commonly used anti-malarial drugs. It is a region, as I've shown you, with the highest prevalence in the country, around 15%. It is a region with the greatest burden of tuberculosis, and a lot of this is driven by the high prevalence of HIV. There's more TB in this part of Kenya than there is in the whole United States. And there are many other infections of public health interest. Schistosomiasis is endemic. A lot of diarrheal diseases. and CDC has a very strong and active collaboration in Kenya with the Kenyan Medical Research Institute, or KEMRI. This is a picture of a fairly typical area around Kisumu. It's very rural. Most people are living are subsistence farmers, very high poverty rates. Most people, you can tell one measure of income level in an area is whether people have a thatched roof or whether they have a tin roof. Most of the roofs in, you can see some tin roofs shining here, but most of the roofs in this part of Kenya are thatched. There's subsistence farmers growing bananas, maize, raising a few cows. And Kisumu is about 40 kilometers actually from where Obama's father's from. And it's not really just over that hill, but kind of, sort of. So CDC's invested a lot in the field station in Kenya and developed a lot of infrastructure. These are some new office buildings that were put up in 2003, just after I arrived. There's a state-of-the-art laboratory that is, you know, doing work in that part of Africa that really is unique. a lot of getting Kenyans trained up to do a lot of the work out there, and taking things very seriously. Here we are celebrating international accreditation for the laboratory, and it was the first CDC lab outside of the United States to be accredited. But there's a lot of problems. As I've shown you, there's a very high prevalence. What are the ramifications of that high prevalence? Here's, based on a study that CDC did in 2002, this was life expectancy at birth for males, 36.7 years. For females, just close to 40 years, and overall about 38.5 years. I like to challenge people to think about the ramifications of life expectancy figures like this. I showed you the regional variation and prevalence by age group for the whole country earlier. In 2004, we conducted an HIV and STD prevalence study amongst about 1,800 individuals in the area, a rural area called Asembo, just near Kisumu. And this shows you the HIV prevalence by age group and sex. I told you I was going to have a lot more of these graphs. Look at the prevalence for young women, college-aged women here, 20 through 24. 33% of the women were HIV infected. And these are women who are in their reproductive years. The males, considerably lower in these younger age groups. And this may reflect that women, young girls, are having sex with older, infected men, plus also that for biological reasons, females are at increased risk for HIV acquisition. Just for comparison, these are the national figures from 2003, the prevalence of HIV, and just to show you how much higher prevalence was for females across these age groups. Sexually transmitted infections, particularly ulcerative sexually transmitted infections like herpes, are important factors in promoting HIV acquisition and transmission, not only through the physical break in the mucosa, but also the local immune response that's elicited brings in the cells that HIV likes to infect. This graph shows the prevalence of herpes by age, group, and sex, and you can see that amongst females above 20 to 24, very high prevalence of herpes in this population. 75% in this group, 90% in the 25 through 29-year age group. Several studies have been done, including one that was done by University of Washington in Kisumu, where they tried to use drugs to suppress herpes in individuals who were in a discordant HIV relationship, to see if reducing herpes would also reduce the risk of transmission to the uninfected partner. Unfortunately, the results for those studies have been quite disappointing. So I mentioned that the main focus of my time in Kenya was on prevention of mother-to-child transmission study. UNAIDS estimates that about 370,000 children under 15 are infected with HIV in 2007, most of those in sub-Saharan Africa. And most of them are infected due to mother-to-child transmission. Mother-to-child transmission can take place whilst the baby is still in the uterus, during labor and delivery, and then about 30% during breastfeeding. Transmission rates are around... Not all mothers will transmit to their baby. So transmission rates in areas that don't have antiretrovirals and in breastfeeding settings are around 25 to 40%. In many of these countries that, you know, resource-limited settings that where there's breastfeeding going on and no antiretrovirals, again, the prevalence of the mothers, the HIV prevalence is very high, as I've shown you in the previous slides. So there are many risk factors that increase the risk for a baby to get infected if the baby's mother is HIV positive. These include the amount of virus that's actually in the mother, and a lot of this can be impacted by antiretroviral drugs. They bring the amount of virus down. The stage of the disease in the mother, those are often reflected by the CD4 cell count or the clinical stage. Other things that occur during the labor itself, how long there's been rupture of membranes, that can also increase the risk the longer it goes. And whether it's a vaginal birth or a cesarean section actually decreases the risk of HIV transmission. The first antiretroviral drug approved in this country was called AZT. It's actually now referred to as ZDV or zidovudine. But a trial done in the early 90s demonstrated that this drug given alone during pregnancy and during labor was effective in reducing mother-to-child transmission with 8.3% transmission in the women who got the drug versus about 25% transmission in women who were in the untreated or placebo arm. Regimens have evolved since then, and now in the United States, most HIV-positive women get three antiretrovirals from early in the second trimester of pregnancy through to delivery, and then, but there's no breastfeeding. Women are encouraged to give formula, so there's no risk of transmission during the breastfeeding period. This graph shows the number of cases of perinatally acquired AIDS cases in the United States, peaking in the early 90s at around 900. And you can see that since the advent of the use of AZT, a dramatic decline to around 100 in 2002. And this really is a in 2005, there were only 57 cases of perinatally acquired HIV, which is a truly remarkable success story for this country. The dramatic declines in the U.S. are related to increased prenatal testing. I talked about the opt-out strategy even in this country, the availability of antiretrovirals and C-section, a safe C-section, good infrastructure, the feasibility of breastfeeding, of not breastfeeding in the U.S. There's safe order, formulas available, readily available, it's affordable. And there really isn't a stigma attached to bottle feeding. So it really is a feasible public health goal to eliminate infant HIV infection. However, in the international setting, there are still many challenges. These include the limited access and distribution of antiretrovirals, although that is improving. Because of this limitation, people have explored the use of single drug or two drugs for use as a prevention of mother-to-child transmission, but they have sort of mixed efficacy. There's all sorts of issues about manpower, healthcare workers, particularly in the rural areas. There's a huge problem with brain drain. The option not to breastfeed is not an option for many women. Their only way to feed their infants is through breastfeeding. And then there's what we refer to as the PMTCT cascade, trying to get women into clinic. A lot of women deliver at home. So trying to get them into the clinic, trying to encourage them to go for testing, and then ultimately, if they are positive, to get on to agree to taking antiretrovirals. Breastfeeding continues to pose a challenge. We know that breastfeeding overall is really the best nutrition for babies. And particularly in resource-limited settings, where it's been shown to improve infant survival. Breastfeeding that is, this is the UN recommendation, that if alternative sources to foods are acceptable, affordable, safe, feasible, and sustainable, then alternatives to breastfeeding should be used. Many of these are not available to most HIV-infected women in these types of settings. As I mentioned, to not breastfeed goes against cultural norms and may stigmatize the mother or lead to disclosure of HIV. There was a program by UNAIDS where they tried to provide women with pre-mixed formula. So they didn't have to mix it. There was no risk of contamination with unsafe water. They gave these women cans of this pre-mixed formula to take home. It didn't work. Why didn't it work? A lot of women took it home. They were immediately labeled as having HIV because they were seen to be bottle feeding. People were saying, why are you bottle feeding? You must have HIV. So it was not a success. Stigma may lead to women being physically abused by the husband, thrown out of the house, and there are many ramifications. Oftentimes, the young woman who's just had a baby may not have all the control over the infant feeding choices. Much of the time, it's influenced by the father and other family members, read mother-in-law. My mother-in-law is actually in the room here, so I should be nice. So we really don't know the best strategy to reduce the transmission of HIV in these settings where the option to breastfeed is not there, or not to breastfeed is not available. So the questions remain: how long should a woman breastfeed? Should a mother get antiretrovirals for this whole duration of time? If she breastfeeds for 2 years, should she be on antiretrovirals for that whole period, despite the fact that, you know, her CD4 count is very high? She's actually at the healthy end of the disease spectrum. There's various studies going on looking at whether the infants themselves should be given antiretrovirals rather than the mother. These are all ongoing at this time. In terms of trying to address this issue, we did a study that we called the Kisumu Breastfeeding Study. The objective was to reduce mother-to-child transmission amongst breastfeeding women in a resource-limited setting using antiretrovirals from late pregnancy through to about 6 months postpartum, with the idea that about that time the infant perhaps could transition to other foods and not rely on formula. We started in 03, we just finished earlier this year, and we enrolled about 500 women and followed them for about 24 months and tested the infants at multiple time points. So what did we show? Well, we showed at about 12 months we had about a 6% transmission amongst the infants. This is I told you earlier that transmission rates with no antiretrovirals is about 40%. So this 6% is about a 75% reduction compared to no intervention and could translate to about a 300,000 fewer new HIV infections, infant HIV infections each year. This is the team that I worked with in Kenya and a few visitors from Atlanta. So I'm going to shift quickly to talk about the work in the orphanage, if I may. UNAIDS estimates that there's probably around 1.5 million orphans in Kenya, and over 50% of them are orphaned due to HIV epidemic. In 2002, Carol Bellamy, the executive director of UNICEF, had this to say: the silence that surrounds children affected by HIV/AIDS and the inaction that results is morally reprehensible and unacceptable. If this situation is not addressed, and not addressed now with increased urgency, millions of children will continue to die, and tens of millions more will be further marginalized, stigmatized, malnourished, uneducated, and psychologically damaged. The orphanage that we got involved in is called the Young Generation Center, or YGC, and is located in a slum area of Kisumu. YGC has actually developed very strong connections with people, friends here in Alaska. Some, I think, in this room have been there. A few months ago, I sat at one of these luncheons. I sat next to a woman who I had not met before. And when I was discussing where I had been and been working, she said she'd also been to Kenya. And on further questioning, she had been right here at YGC. And many people in Anchorage have supported activities there, and I really want to thank them. We first got involved because of the persistence of the director, a lady called Celine, who invited us to come and see the place where she and a few members of the community were caring for about 100 orphan children. These pictures sort of show how things were back at that time in 2002. This is an old, this is a school building, mud walled, that's sort of crumbling. This is a kitchen. This is where they were cooking their food over three rocks. This is a pit latrine that's serving 100 kids. It's actually sort of collapsing and sinking into the ground. So we were able to contribute some money and solicited money from friends back here in Anchorage. And along with the Lions Club, we were able to help build a new dining hall here. There's a kitchen in here and a storeroom here. This is a kitchen with some nice fuel-conserving stoves. They are lined with bricks. We, courtesy of a single donation from Dr. Colleen Murphy, we were able to tear down the pit latrine and build a new shower and toilet block. But fixing the infrastructure isn't the only solution. Obviously, avoiding them becoming orphans should be a key intervention. Preventing parents from becoming infected, and if infected, making sure that they get onto antivirals. In the event of a death of one or both parents, these children should be supported through their extended family where possible, rather than being taken to orphanages. The children need to be educated, provided with vocational skills, empowered, provided protection of their legal rights, particularly around land. A lot of them lose the land that their parents owned. It gets taken over by neighbors or other relatives. And they obviously need to have their emotional needs addressed. In 2003, the director, Celine, asked us to provide secondary school sponsorship for one girl at the orphanage, this girl right here. And I'll never forget the joy on this girl's face, and in fact, all the kids at the orphanage, when she first put on her school uniform and pulled out all the things that she was taking to her boarding school, her mattress, her books. It was a very powerful moment. And since then, we've tried to sponsor about 40 kids each year in secondary schools. It costs about $600 per child per year, or about $2,500 for 4 years of secondary. And we now operate a nonprofit under the umbrella of the Alaska Community Foundation that is raising money for this purpose. And actually, there are some brochures that will be on the table back there.
I'll hand them out.
Joe Davis is here, and he's very involved in that process. These are kids. These are some boys who are attending a secondary school locally. We approached ACF and asked them. We told them that we thought that that old mud wall school building was about to collapse, and perhaps we should try and raise some money to build a new school. They told us to contact Nate York, who also operates through ACF. In a nonprofit organization called Solace International. Nate came and visited, and after a couple of days decided that, yes, he would get involved. He helped build this school on the grounds, and that partnership with Solace International has really taken off and is an incredible story to tell. And we really want to thank Nate and Solace International for that support. I think with that, I will end my talk. The views and spelling expressed in this presentation are my views and do not present the views necessarily of CDC. So thank you, and hopefully I didn't go on too long.
We have time for just a couple questions. Does anyone have one?
No. Medication, you say it so fast, I can't.
Antiretrovirals.
Antiretrovirals. Is it true that
there's been a change in terms of the amount charged by the pharmaceutical industry, in fact, that there may be free medications of this kind available in Africa?
Antiretrovirals are provided for free in Kenya, and a lot of that is because of the funding through PEPFAR, through the Global AIDS Fund. So yes, it's essentially free. And a lot of the work that the Clinton Foundation did was to try and get pharmaceutical companies to reduce the price and also promote the use of generics.
I'm gone. I'm going to thank you very much for your presentation, Tim. And he is a board member, and I'm sure he already has a mug, but there's one for your partner.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And a few other goodies.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next meeting will be on December 11th, and it will be Andrea Baker. She's the director of Enterprise 2.0, and she will speak to us on innovating bureaucracy, getting government to share. And we hope to see you all then. Thank you.